The following audio file was recorded on April 8th in Nashville, Tennessee by Earnhardt Productions Incorporated at a voting rights and election reform conference titled Gathering to Save Our Democracy. It has been uploaded to this site courtesy of the January 30th Coalition, an Ohio-based voting rights group which endorsed the conference. You are welcome to copy and distribute or broadcast this recording. Please also consider making a donation to Radio for All so that recordings like this one can continue to be made available.
Our next panel is focusing on the broad issue again of election reform, and we have an eclectic mix of organizations represented on our afternoon panel. The panelists are listed and their biographies are in your packet. We are very pleased to have on the panel, and they'll speak in this order: Larry English, Barbara Burt, Warren Stewart, Laura Schaefer, Teresa Hummel, Phil Fry, and Larry Quick. Larry, you want to start us?
Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome to my hometown. I had the privilege to work with some of you January 5th and 6th in Washington, and to go to Ohio, Columbus, for the January 30 group, and I'll be sharing some of the results of that. Bernie reminded me that I had 15 minutes. I do a lot of speaking, keynoting of conferences, and when people ask me how much time I need, I say about 15 minutes longer than what you give me. So, Bernie, my time is up. So I'm now into overtime, so start your clock. Okay. Now, I want to start by thinking about the outcomes that we need to accomplish as a result of what we're starting here and will continue as we leave from here to go back and do good things. So I'd like for us to do an exercise. So if everybody will please stand, I would like for you to do this with me. This is very participative now. I want you to pair off, find a partner and pair off with them, please. Okay, so find somebody and pair off. And What I'd like for you to do is look your partner into the eyes. Look into their eyes. Face them. Look into their eyes. And I want you to repeat to them, say with to them after me or with me, say, "I love your election results." Say it. Come on, say it. "I love your election results." All right. Okay. Please be seated. I believe that this is our objective for why we're here. Is that not? It's not to talk about the problem. It's to solve the problem. And the only way that we can create genuine election reform is by applying the same kinds of sound quality management principles that world-class companies have applied to manufacturing. I have been applying since 1990 quality management principles to our information processes. And it is through those proven techniques that we can improve processes and put them in control and eliminate the problems that we've seen in the past. I want to address some of the problems. I want to provide for us a voter's bill of rights that we need to stand behind and implement. What are the quality principles that we need to apply? What are root causes? We need to understand and analyze root causes. So when we make improvements and reform those processes, they will be permanent improvements. And then there's a couple of appendices, the group that got together in a focus group to actually analyze root causes and to identify some defined improvements for that, and a summary of the election reform analysis or election analysis that I did of the year 2000 election. If you don't have a copy of that, there are copies in the back. If we run out, I do have a few more. And there's a copy of the handout of my slides. So if you have not gotten one, Chick at the back has some right now. We're out of the frying pan and into the fire. When I saw the problems that we had That was, everybody acknowledged that that was a national disaster. What really happened with this reform of the Help America Vote Act? Did it solve the problem? Absolutely not. It's worse now, is it not? And it will continue to get worse until we get to the root and solve the root. You see, that attacked the symptoms. I think we need an audit of how the monies have been spent out of that act. We need to know how much was spent in swapping out technology. We need to also know there's provisions in there for improving processes. I would like to know how much money has actually been spent improving processes and what kinds of techniques and principles have been applied to do it. Were they the right ones? So, how do we solve it? Well, the legislation is being there, but here is that warning. We must apply sound quality management principles if we are going to truly solve the problem. Now, let me ask, it's very interesting, our language. Words are important. Meanings are important. Why do we say this candidate won the election and this candidate lost the election? Isn't it supposed to be we, the people, elected you as president? Yes, that's the way it is supposed to work. The focus needs to be on the customer, the voters, not on the sellers. So first of all, our voters need an absolute right to have access to easy registration and accurate registration so they have the ability to vote. Every legally registered voter needs to have an uninfringed right to cast their vote. Now, that's not all. Every voter must have an uninfringed right to have access to the voting process to be able to get there and to be able to cast their vote, and to have a voter-friendly system that enables them to understand for whom they are, for what they are voting, so that they can assure and verify their own vote before they leave and punch the button to cast it or drop it in the box. Every voter shall have a voting process that assures his or her vote is recorded accurately and unambiguously as intended, regardless of the media. Every voter shall have the right to validate and verify that they have actually voted for who they intended to vote for. One of the discrepancies in the exit polls is, I thought I voted for this candidate, but through some mix-up, my vote got cast for someone else. Every voter shall have a right to verify that his vote has been counted and recounted accurately and verifiably. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the fact that we have a recount vote process is a fundamental indictment that we have a broken election process. We have a broken voting process that we need to do recounts. In manufacturing, that's called information scrap and rework. Manufacturing scrap and rework, and we have the same problem here. Every voter shall have the right to have their registration information secured and protected from fraudulent use. That means no purging of the rolls without my permission of my record. Election reform goal. I believe that we need to do like Toyota and like other world-class companies like Intel. We need a zero defects process for voting. World-class companies ascribe to no defects, because defects cost. And the results of a defective voting process puts the wrong person into office who has the ability then to provide the governing of us, we the people. Goal, reduce, I call in my election reform article a goal of every election year, every biennium, to reduce the number of defective votes by 50%. And in the year 2000 election, presidential election, there were from 4,000 to 6,000 spoiled votes. I'm sure that we had that many, if not more, in this election. So let's just take that 5 million figure of spoiled votes. These represent 5 million disenfranchised voters. If we start now and make improvements, we can eliminate that to half of that. And by 2008, a little over a million. And these are feasible without major cost to the processes. Now, by the time we get to the year 2032, we're down to what is technically called zero defects, or Six Sigma level quality. To do so requires vigorous reform using statistically proven quality improvement principles and techniques. Here are the improvements that every valid quality system uses. Customer focus. That means we, the citizens, are the customers of our government. And the voters who care enough to vote to elect people, these are the ones for whom we must have customer satisfaction. And those of us who are not satisfied, we need to complain. We need to complain. So we've got to become a part of the process to complain and let the problems that you're identifying be known. We must apply process improvement. It's not about recounts and trying to fix or identify those the intentions of the voter from those votes that are ambiguous. We've got to have a clear improvement, radical improvement, or an incremental improvement to get to our goal. And using the same scientific principles that are applied to any valid quality system. So statistical quality control, we've got to have absolute controls on these processes to prevent external variation and inadvertent variation. So quality control charts. Process improvement, PDCA, Plan, Do, Check, Act, is the fundamental process improvement technique that Japan used to transform the economy of the world in manufacturing. And we must apply it to our information, to our election processes. And finally, management accountability is a part of every sound quality management system. So managers, the executives at the top, have to be held accountable for the brokenness of the process and for fixing the processes. Now, here's the fundamental Plan, Do, Check, Act, the process improvement. You first of all plan an improvement when you identify broken processes like you have so eloquently articulated here. And so we study that. We get together with people who perform that work and analyze root cause. Then, only then, when we understand the real root causes, do we define improvements that then we can go out and implement. Now, when we implement those improvements, we have to do them in a controlled way. We plan, so we define our improvements. We implement in a controlled way. Then we come back and check to see if the improvements work and did not introduce negative side effect. The butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County was an example of having done a plan of an improvement to increase the font size for the legibility for the older population, but not doing implementing in a controlled fashion. So the checking to see if that worked was not discovered until the morning of election day when the voters came out and said, I think I voted for the wrong person. And then it was too late to correct it. And then once we have done that, then we can act to roll it out, put that process into control, go on to the next process that we need to solve. In a partisan stage, how do we get to a non-blame, non-judgmental environment? How do we get that? We've got to focus on the citizens and not on the party objectives. We've got to focus on the good of the people. Assemble people who can do it, plan, and we've just described the processes here. So let me get through. As an outcome of looking at the recount process, this is a fishbone diagram, and this is a tool that Kairu Ishikawa gave us for analyzing root causes in different categories. The people role, and that's the voters, the election officials, it is the poll workers, the materials, that's the actual vote, the electronic vote recorded, the paper ballot, the machines and the software and the hardware of the voting process. And then down at the bottom, the methods, the defined procedures or the absence of procedures. Measurement, what are the measurement techniques on the bottom left of the diagram? And on the top left, management environment. What are the things that influence the process? They're not part of the process. And that's where the major root causes are. Now, anybody can come sit together and brainstorm. What are the things that cause the breaks in the system, whatever process we're looking at? And analyze potential causes and then ask the question, why? Why did this happen? Why did we have people who didn't follow the recount procedures? Well, they weren't trained. Why were people not trained? Do we have an accountability in the environment of zero defects? We don't have a zero defects mindset in the election processes. We know that because a 2% spoiled vote was an accepted standard factor in the election processes themselves. Well, my time is short, and here you can read for the some of the defined improvements that the group identified in J30. There's more information in the back. But what I would like to also speak to are, I'm very proud of the work that you all are doing in identifying and measuring the problems. And what I would like to give us some guidelines on, we need to be able to present these, and when you present this information, it will be challenged. What did Spitzer say? He said, I can't bring a suit based upon polling data alone. No, but you've got an awful lot of evidence that altogether you cannot deny. So plan your assessment and analysis with an objective mindset. Use statistical sampling techniques for gathering your information. Document exactly how you gathered the information. And you want to gather that information from the authoritative source. So if you're gathering vote data, get the official vote results. Get the official ballots. Get the whatever you're able to get. Document that. Error-proof the processes that you for your gathering that information and making any adjustments or moving the data as you need. Document and control your chain of custody for the information that you've had so no tampering has taken place there in the analysis process. Document the anomalies that you see either in getting the information or in the processes you observed or as you're analyzing it. Look at those patterns. And you can make some safe assumptions as to what may have caused that particular pattern. But always document the assumptions that you make. Present your information graphically in a way that's intuitive for lay people, your peers, your counterparts out there who we're championing their cause. But at the same time, you have to use statistically sound techniques and principles to document the problems and to document how you've conducted this analysis so it will stand up to challenge. Will it be useful as court testimony, for example? Because you will be cross-examined on it. But if you can stand behind the assumptions, then your challenger has to say, okay, well, if here is the assumption that we need to modify, and then you can go recalculate. And then thirdly, finally, communicate. Peter Drucker is one of my mentors, the great management consultant. I'll never forget in a class that I had from him, he said, who in the organization needs to know what you're doing? When he was talking about the effectiveness that we have, let them know, he said. So my words for us here, who in this country needs to know what you are doing? Everyone. Let them know. Take every opportunity, write letters to the editor, get interviewed, communicate to your peers, the people in your circle of influence, and the evidence is so overwhelming, it will start getting recognized in the places that need it. So, the end result, we can accomplish this. Let me, I have just one wrap-up. I think one of the incredible ironies is the party who is in power now and benefited from the anomalies and irregularities in this election is the very party that ran on the values platform. What is a more fundamental value in a free democratic society than an uninfringed right to vote and have your vote counted as you intended? So that we can end up with a government of the people, by the people, and not for the special interest groups, but for the people. Thank you very much. Go continue the fight. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I don't know, I used to have an art history class when I was in college about this time, and the lights got dim, and I sort of snoozed through it. So I'll try and keep you awake, but I know this is a tough time, and it's a gorgeous day outside. I hope everybody's been out there. My name is Barbara Burt, and I am the team leader for the election reform team at Common Cause. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about what Common Cause is. I'm sure it's a name that you've all heard before. In fact, it's been mentioned many times since about noontime yesterday at this conference. But I think that there are a few things about it that may not be as evident to those of you who are not members. So I just wanted to give you a little background. Common Cause started in 1970. It is a nonpartisan organization. And when I say that, I mean that very seriously. So I'm not going to stand up here and talk about who won the election. That's not my issue. My issue is that elections be open and fair, that people have the chance to vote, and that the accuracy of them is something that can be proven. We were started by John Gardner. He was a Republican. He was the Secretary of Health and Human Services under Lyndon Johnson, and he quit the Johnson administration because he disagreed with the Vietnam War. John Gardner felt that everybody was organized but the people, and he set out to create an organization that would give power to the people. And today we call our organizational motto, Holding Power Accountable. So right now, maybe we're doing things that annoy the Republican administration, but that's because they're in power. If it were the Democrats, we would be the same pain in the neck to them as well. I wanted to add a couple of things to Larry English's list of the voters' rights. And one is competitive elections. I think that we haven't been thinking about that very much, but that's very much in the minds of those of us at Common Cause. Very few congressional elections in the United States are actually competitive these days. The districts have been gerrymandered by both parties, depends on where you live, and often there's no primary, and the actual outcome of the final election is a given. I think in many states there was absolutely no change if an incumbent ran. That's not true. I'm sorry, that is not true. I'll skip this part about what I was talking about to address these concerns. Common Cause has over 400,000 members and supporters and activists. And we, as an organization, can't legislate what our members say and do. It is a fact that our organization stands for a voter-verified paper ballot. We are working very hard in many states to pass that, including North Carolina, and I believe that will pass in North Carolina. So I'm sorry that people feel that way. It is absolutely not true. You can go to our website and read our election reform agenda. But as I said, we do not control what our members say when they're outside of our organization. One of the things that Larry did say that I want to take a little bit of issue with was that, and I understand where he was going with it, but he said that we the citizens, are the customers of our government. And I think that's not the way I really want to look at it. We actually are our government. And unfortunately, at least right now, as far as I'm concerned, our government reflects us. And so I think we need to always keep that uppermost in our mind, that our government isn't them, and we are not us. You know, it's not us versus them, although it really feels that way. And that's what we have to change. We have to move to the point where, again, we have taken responsibility back from professionals who have captured the media and have captured the attention of people. We as just regular everyday people have to reassert our power. Common Cause has a staff of about 40 people in Washington, D.C., and we work on a number of issues. Ethics, right now we are working very hard to change the ethics rules in Congress, and we're hoping that this will rebound on Tom DeLay. If you are interested in that issue, check our website. We have a petition. In fact, our president, Shelley Pingree, spoke on this spoke at a press conference recently on this issue. Media reform is a very big issue for us. If you care about that, and you should if you care about elections, because they're very much related, check out the information on that. As I was talking about earlier, redistricting is something that we're working on in a number of states, and we will be for the coming years, because we believe that elections not only need to be transparent, open, available to all, but also there need to be good candidates to vote for. What good does it do if you can vote and count, have your vote count, if the person you're voting for is not the person you would like to vote for? The other big issue that we've worked on for many years is campaign finance reform. We also have state organizations. We have 38 state organizations, and we have staff in about 24 of them. Sometimes it's just a paid lobbyist, sometimes just an executive director, never in a very fancy setting or with an abundance of staff or facilities. But these are people who know the legislature, know the policies, know the history, usually, and they can be very good advocates. So if you're part of an organization that is working on an issue and you feel that there's no way to be heard, I would definitely recommend that you talk to someone at Common Cause, either in our national office. If it's about elections, you can give me a call or email me. Or in your state, if we do have a state office there, because you may find a very powerful and helpful ally there. Sometimes we don't have any paid staff in a state, and that's just a volunteer committee. But those people also have learned, many of them have been with us for a number of years, and they know the issues, and they know the history, and again, they know how to make the system work. We've had a long history with election reform. We were one of the groups working on getting the 18-year-olds the vote. This past election, we ran an election phone line similar to what you've heard about the election protection line. This phone line we did in conjunction with the Reform Institute, which is a group that John McCain is part of, and NBC News and several other organizations. And we received more than 200,000 calls on this phone line. And we are currently in the process of analyzing the data. Each of the people who called had the option of giving us a 60-second description of what their problem was. So we now have 55,000 calls with this 60-second description that we're going through. We did a poll online with our members in after the election, actually, it was at the beginning of the year, to ask them which issues they were most interested in having us work on. And election reform was their number one issue. So we have been putting a lot of attention into this area. I wanted to tell you a little story about sort of the process, because what I'm talking about is really the hard work of reform. And I know you've heard some really great speakers earlier today, and there are a lot of very absolute ideas, but we're talking about legislation, which is important. I know that it's very slow and very boring, and it can be extremely frustrating. As someone said, it's like watching sausages be made. You don't want to know what all the, you know, what the bad things are that can happen. But it is necessary. I mean, if we're a democracy, we need to work within that system. And we need to stop people who are not working within that system, obviously. But I want to tell you a little bit about the state of Maine, which happens to be where I live, and the passage of their paper ballot bill there. A group of people came together, similar to you, very well informed about the machine issue and very concerned about the fact that Maine, which currently had no DREs, might be about to buy some due to the HAVA requirements that each polling place have a machine that is accessible to disabled voters. So this group came to me, and I became part of it, and we went looking for a legislative sponsor for a paper trail bill, and we found one. She was very helpful. She thought that we had a good chance of getting the bill passed, and she started talking with her legislative colleagues, and we started talking with other groups and, you know, just regular voters in the state of Maine. There were hearings, which we attended and testified at, and things looked pretty good until the Secretary of State decided that he really didn't like this. And this happens in many states. It's all about power and who can control what. And he felt that he didn't want the legislature making this law. He was concerned. So when the Secretary of State steps in on an election issue, legislators tend to listen because that person is the person who's doing, you know, sort of the daily work on elections and supposedly has all the knowledge. He was adamant. We were adamant. And it looked like there was going to be an impasse and that actually we would lose because the committee that was in charge of moving the bill out to the floor was not about to disregard the Secretary of State's comments. So we kept working on this, and we kept talking with them, and there was a lot of dialogue back and forth, meetings in the Secretary of State's office, meetings in the State House, meetings among our group, meetings among legislators. And finally, a compromise was reached that would say no new machines could be bought, but it also did not mandate the paper ballot at that point. Now, we happen to know that this Secretary of State was term limited. This was going to be his last year. And we also knew that the likely person coming in next was going to be much more favorable to our issue. And so after much talking back and forth, we determined that actually it made sense to make this compromise. And sure enough, this year, we have a much stronger bill that will pass with no problem. But it's this kind of dialogue, you know, listening to people that you don't agree with, but trying to find some way of working with them that is so difficult. And it's the part of this work that is in some ways thrilling, if you're like me, or exceedingly frustrating if you're the kind of person who wants things to happen right away. But it is absolutely vital. And what I would like to offer as Common Cause, a group that has tremendous experience in this field, is our expertise and our ability to help you get these kinds of issues passed in your legislatures and at the federal level as well, where we also have lobbyists and we also do a lot of work. We have things that you can help us with in terms of giving us on-the-ground information. Many of you are experts in ways that we cannot hope to be. So I think together there's a lot of synergy. And I would just like to invite you to join us in partnership whenever it is possible and whenever you think it would be helpful to your cause. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I've been asked to talk about federal election reform legislation. The Help America Vote Act of 2002 addressed many of the issues that rose to the surface in the 2000 presidential election. In doing so, HAVA, as it is familiarly called, initiated change, and the activity surrounding that change has caused many more issues to surface. In particular, the movement toward electronic voting has caused citizens and government officials alike to take a greater interest in the election equipment used to record and count votes. There are many of you who are committed to the goal of 100% hand-counted paper ballots. Clearly, this would be my preference as well, and I encourage the energy that is being directed towards this goal. At the same time, I recognize that this goal is unlikely to be achieved in the short term, and there's an urgent need for meaningful changes to the election procedures that will take effect before the 2006 election. Not only because of the necessity of ensuring voters' confidence in the results of that election, but also because of the looming deadlines for federal appropriations mandated by HAVA. With states currently making purchasing decisions in order to use HAVA funds that must be spent before 2006, a paper record requirement is needed as soon as possible so that the money is not spent on another generation of paperless electronic voting machines. Without dismissing in any way the importance of voting rights issues and concerns about suppression and denied accessibility, there is an overwhelming imperative to address concerns over verification and accuracy. Specifically, I would stress the following concerns that demand immediate attention. While HAVA, Section 301A5, requires voting systems shall comply with an error rate standard established under Section 321 of the voting system standards issued by the Federal Election Commission, most recently in 2002, there are currently no methods in place to ensure that voting systems are, in fact, in compliance with that requirement. It's a bit like having fuel emissions standards without doing smog checks. Also, the processes by which election equipment, hardware, and software are developed, tested, and certified, processes that are rightfully the business of the American people, are kept secret from both the public and the government. Trade secret laws protect the manufacturers from revealing the inner workings of their products, and confidential agreements between manufacturers and the testing authorities prohibit the public from overseeing the testing process or knowing the detailed results. And finally, election officials, experienced in election administration but novices with computers, find themselves over their heads as they use computers to administer elections. In order to perform their duties efficiently, they have grown to depend more and more on election system manufacturers, salespeople, and technicians for information, guidance, and technical assistance. As a result, manufacturers whose mission is to increase company profits rather than election officials whose mission is to administer fair and accurate elections are controlling more and more of the election process. Several comprehensive omnibus bills have been introduced in the 109th Congress that address a wide range of election reform issues, in particular Senator Clinton's Count Every Vote Act, S-450, and its companion bill in the House, which was introduced by Representative Tubbs Jones. While others focus more narrowly on verification accuracy and different specific issues. While Clinton's Count Every Vote Act is impressive in its sweeping overhaul of the election process, we anticipate that it will encounter significant opposition and is unlikely to be passed in the current session. Additionally, the specific verification language is problematic. It mandates the purchase of voting system technology that does not currently exist, and it has to be bought before 2006. It also has the effect of prohibiting certain devices that currently provide verification for disabled voters and may require some states to abandon paper-based voting systems for electronic machines. Senator Dodd's comprehensive, Democratic leadership bill, S-17, is seriously flawed and does not deserve the support of activists concerned about addressing the problems posed by paperless electronic voting machines. Sadly, most of the verification language from S-17 was included in Representative Conyers' bill, H.R. 533, and while there's much to applaud in the House version, specifically the Section 2 that deals with voting rights, it shares too many of the flaws found in S-17 and should not be supported by election reform advocates. All these bills stand little chance of movement in the current Congress, not only because they are so decidedly Democratic bills, though that certainly doesn't help. Actually, their biggest political liability, in my opinion, is precisely their comprehensiveness. by addressing so many issues, some relatively uncontentious and others more so, they provide too many political bullseyes that will inevitably keep them from even reaching a vote. There are several more narrowly focused election reform bills, including Senator Cole's bill to move Election Day to a Sunday, bills in both houses to eliminate the Electoral College, Senator Lautenberg's bill prohibiting partisan conflict of interest in chief state election officials, and of course, Representative Jackson's constitutional amendment to establish the right to vote. But I only have 15 minutes here. Similarly, we only have a very brief window to make changes that will have an effect on the 2006 elections that might make the 110th Congress a Congress that could address some of those issues. So I'm going to focus on verification and accuracy. Senator Ensign from Nevada has introduced a bill, the Voting Integrity and Verification Act. This is S-330. It's hard to keep track of all these numbers. I apologize. It has a companion bill in the House, 704, introduced by another Nevada Republican, that being Representative Gibbons. And though they're limited to merely establishing the requirement for a voter-verifiable paper record in federal elections, it would be an important first step. It has the political advantage of Republican introduction and bipartisan co-sponsorship. It also has the advantage of a very good acronym, VIVA. But it's only a first step. By contrast, Representative Rush Holt's Voter Confidence and Increased Accessibility Act, H.R. 550, is the best verification and audit bill currently introduced. The language in 550 is the result of years of ongoing dialogue with election reform advocates, computer specialists, and a variety of organizations advocating for the disabled community, and if enacted, would significantly and immediately increase confidence in the accuracy of elections. Currently, with over 120 co-sponsors in the House, 550 has more co-sponsorship than all the other election reform bills combined. A similar bill in the last session had 157 co-sponsors, the result of significant constituent effort and the inherent strength of the bill. We are optimistic that an even better bipartisan bill will be introduced next week in the Senate. This bill, like the Holt bill in the House, addresses the areas of neglect that have been revealed by the increased public scrutiny on voting systems. Elections are the business of the American people, the most important business of democracy. Through decades of public neglect, vote counting processes have become hidden from the people and have slipped out from under government control. The bill that we're anticipating is intended to restore the rightful ownership of the election process to the American people. These bills can gain widespread bipartisan support because they are just common sense. They provide a necessary redundancy that serves as a safety net when machines malfunction, and they provide a mechanism that will at least partially restore voters' confidence in the accuracy of voting systems. They are about honesty and integrity and the foundations of democracy. Through the ongoing efforts of activists like those participating in this conference, it is possible that even in this session of Congress, we can see legislation that mandates a voter-verifiable paper record of all votes, ensuring that the documents necessary for meaningful audits are available. We can see legislation that requires and defines meaningful audits, providing methods for ensuring that election systems satisfy the accuracy requirements that are already part of federal law. We can get legislation that allows public scrutiny of the vote counting procedures performed by election equipment, the testing processes by which that election equipment is certified for use in election, and the audit process by which the accuracy of the equipment is verified. We can also get legislation that prohibits financial conflicts of interest between manufacturers, testing authorities, and election officials. All this is because accurate elections are fundamental to the democratic process, and every voter wants their votes to be counted as cast. Such legislation should have the enthusiastic support of those concerned about accuracy of voting systems, and if enacted, would have a tremendous positive impact on the election process in this country. The last 5 months have had their share of disappointments and frustrations, as I've been working along with so many of you on revealing what happened in November. But my strongest memory of these months is the remarkable people that I've had the opportunity to work with. The word patriot has taken on a lot of unfortunate associations lately, and I've become sadly unaccustomed to hearing it used with its true meaning. But these people are truly patriots. All those working to preserve democracy and ensure the integrity of elections in this country are an inspiration to us all. In particular, it has been an honor to get to know Richard Hayes Phillips. I'm going to single you out this afternoon. There he is. He has joined with Buddha, Monteverdi, Gandhi, Jimi Hendrix, and Tom York on my list of heroes. And I'll tell you, you can't do a lot better than that, in my opinion. And these are my sources of inspiration. There was one morning after we'd both been up all night crunching numbers. I think it was a Sunday morning, early December. And he called me up. We'd both been up. And he wanted to read to me some words written by Thomas Paine. They came from a pamphlet that Paine wrote that was to be read to soldiers fighting in the snow in Valley Forge. We all know the first line, but I had never heard the rest of the first paragraph and was surprised to learn that the winter soldier hearings in 1971 drew their name from this pamphlet. I'd always thought it was because they were held in December. I would like to leave you with these remarkable words, and though I cannot possibly deliver these words with the passionate intensity that inspired Richard that morning, I hope I can capture some of their sincerity and nobility. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. We are all winter soldiers in the noble cause of defending democracy. Stay free.